field of program analysis. And what I'm going to try to do, rather than give an overview of a set of projects, as many of the talks have been, I'm going to go into depth on one project, just to give you a feel for the kind of work that we do at the interface between software engineering and programming languages in the program analysis community. Now, I asked you that question about compiler technology because what I'm going to try to do is be very intuitive. Okay, so I'm going to discuss everything at an intuitive level. It'll have all the pieces of what we do, but none of the details, none of the formal modeling. So I want you to get an idea of what are the problems we solve, how do we go about solving them, and how do we show empirically, I can hear myself in this, how do we show empirically through experimentation that the solutions are viable and practical. Okay. And clearly this work is collaborative. Bruno is one of my graduate students still back at Rutgers, hopefully finishing this year. So let me talk a little bit about the problem domain. We are looking at framework-based applications. Now, these are applications built in object-oriented languages like Java or C#. And the whole idea of the application is that the person has lots of different specialized libraries, specialized frameworks for a particular application domain. And the developer really just writes a little bit of code, kind of the tip of the iceberg up here. Interesting. It doesn't show. No. Okay. The tip of the iceberg at the top of that triangle, and there's a little bit of code that's written by the developer. The bulk of the code is unfamiliar to the developer. Okay. And these are programs of a complexity and of a sort that are not usually looked at in the academic research community because they don't have good benchmarks to look at, and because they're not very clean programs, okay? They're not very easy to look at. Things like e-commerce sites with auctions, online reservation systems, system software built on top of Apache's Tomcat framework, these are the kinds of things that I'm talking about. And the programs are not just big. In the 70s, people talked about programming in the large as introducing new problems as compared to programming in the small program where people wrote programs that only one person had to work on instead of a team. But here, the programs are not just large. There's many, many kinds of complex interactions that happen between these frameworks and the libraries that might not have been foreseen by the library writers. And this sometimes causes problems of performance. And often the problems we see span multiple layers between different libraries. And that makes them harder to deal with. And the other thing that's true is that many times you don't see these problems until these applications are deployed in the real world, and then they don't work quite as quickly or don't work quite as efficiently as people wanted them to. Now, the software community has had a long history of being able to analyze different kinds of large programs, but these programs have certain characteristics that make them unusual. So first of all, compile time or static analysis requires you to look at the entire program, to build a model of the entire program in order to try to analyze it and understand it better and find the reasons for the problems. Now these problems are basically too big to build a detailed model and then to walk through that model and try to accumulate analysis information. They're too complex to do it for the whole program. And if you want to just profile the program, run it, and collect information, the difficulty is that the performance problems only happen in these production runs. And if you impinge on that run too much, you put in too much instrumentation, you try to collect too much data during the run, then you're actually going to perturb the run, and you may perturb the way it behaves. Moreover, if it's in production, your customers are all going to scream at you because this stuff is not going to work very well because there's too much overhead from the instrumentation. So what we would like to do with these programs is that we would like to design a particular kind of new analysis that fits this setting, okay? And that's the objective of our work here. So this is the roadmap. I'm going to be showing this slide several times through the talk as we go down the different bullets so that you can tell where we are, okay? So what we want to do is we want to come up with new kinds of program analysis to help people when they have these complex pieces of software and they have to diagnose what's wrong. They see a performance problem. It's working too slowly. What's the matter? How can they find the reason for the difficulty? Well, we would like to do that. That's one goal. A second goal is just to understand better these kinds of applications. People haven't really studied different ways of optimizing these kinds of applications. So if you're a library writer, you write the library, and you test the library, you test the classes and the methods in the library, and you can make that library run pretty fast. But you can't envision necessarily how that library is going to be used, how that library may interact with another library. And that's the kind of thing that's happening in these applications to make things go slowly. If you could look at the whole application, what we would like to do as our goal is if we see some API interactions that happen often enough between different libraries in the system, then we can specialize them. Okay, we can emit code in the compiler that says, if certain parameters are equal to these sorts of things, do this translation, which has been optimized for that frequently occurring situation. And if not, you just do the regular translation. So that's code specialization, which is common in OO languages. We also can help researchers pick better benchmarks that are more similar to what they will see in production. In production software, and so that when they come up with techniques, they're really testing them out on realistic benchmarks, okay, and that makes a difference. And sometimes it's just a matter of one library calling another and using the wrong combination of APIs, and there are other APIs and other combinations of the methods in the two libraries that could work better together, or in the three libraries that could work better together. And so those are the kinds of things that we might use to fix the problems once we have identified the problems. So all this has been very high level, and so what we did was we picked a particular problem called object churn. In an OO language, and in these kinds of applications, really what you're doing is not, most of the time, is taking data out of databases, massaging it, and basically processing data, converting data from one kind to another, taking different fields of different objects and putting them together. Think about a transaction system where you're examining your stock portfolio, you're examining your investments, you're going into different databases, and you're building a representation of what you really have. In those kinds of programs, oftentimes intermediate steps use temporary data structures. Okay, they take something out of a database, store it into something, do some transformations on it, and then build a new object or a new data structure of several objects from it. And those temporary data structures are used for a specific amount of time and then thrown away. That's what a temporary variable is like, right? The problem is, if there is an overuse of these temporaries, the cost of creating the objects in them and the cost of initializing the objects in them can really become quite burdensome. And that's what we call object churn in these applications. When you're creating too many temporary objects to put into data structures and you're initializing them over and over again, often unnecessarily. And the unnecessary nature of this is because these objects are created as part of call chains that go between these libraries rather than just within one library, which the library writer could fix. So the big question we want to answer is, can we identify when this happens in these applications? Because that is a precondition to being able to go in and fixing it. All right? So if we're going to be able to identify an overuse of temporary in one of these applications, the first thing we have to do is figure out which of the objects are temporary, are used as temporaries, and which are the things that the application is supposed to be building and sending back to the user. And to do that, we have to look at something called object lifetime. So I want to make sure you understand what this is. When an object is created at execution time, it exists in the heap for a certain amount of time, and eventually there's the last use of the object on that execution, and that period of time is called its lifetime, okay? So if we were running the program and watching the heap and watching all of the objects in the heap and we could see the last time it was accessed on an execution, that would give us the lifetime. But that's a pretty heavyweight way of doing things. So what we're going to try to do is come up with an analysis that approximates the lifetime so that we know when that object is no longer used. And if we find objects that are used deep in the computation and then no longer used, that's what we're going to call a temporary. Whereas an object that's long-lived, that stays in the heap in a long time, is probably not a temporary. Okay, so that's the way we distinguish what's a temporary data structure or object and what's an actual a product of the computation. Everybody okay with that? Okay, intuitively? So we're going to try to find contexts of execution. So what is? Let's think mentally about what an execution looks like. In an object-oriented program, an execution is it starts in some main program, right, in Java, and then goes through a sequence of method calls. And the whole execution is a sequence of method calls. For those of you that have taken a compiler course, you know that a mental model you can have of how the execution actually works is you can think of a runtime stack. And as you go into a procedure or into a method, you put a little frame on the stack. And when you leave that invocation, you take the frame off. So there's always this stack of executing methods that haven't been returned from that tells you the context in which your computation is happening. Okay? Now, what we want to do is find contexts during execution where there's too much of this overuse of temporaries. And then maybe we can look at that sequence of calls and fix it in one of the ways I talked about. Okay. This isn't the same as trying to find a place in the program where objects are created and lots of objects are created. It's not the same as that. Because what we're looking for is a place where objects are used in a particular way, not just created, but actually used. Okay? So we can't just instrument the allocation sites and get this answer. And then we have some strategies here for how we could, you know, what kind of fix-ups we could do if we're able to identify this problem. Sometimes we can look at these patterns of usage between libraries and frameworks and specialize them. Sometimes we can find a data structure that's temporary and all of its fields, except for one, are constant, and we can use a cache. We can create it the first time and keep it in the library, and as the execution continues, we can reuse that same space, so we don't have to reinitialize it, we don't have to recreate it. There are other ways of trying to do that. Okay, I wanted to show you current practice. So this is actually something that's very intuitive, although it may not look that way now. This is a screenshot of an execution. Time is going down on this slide, and the stacks, the call stacks, are going across. So that's the top of the stack. So the currently executing method is at the top of one of these horizontal lines, okay? And if you click on one of these things, you can drill down and see portions of it in more detail, all right? This is a dynamic analysis tool that developers at IBM are using. This is a research prototype, but this kind of tool is the kind of thing people have. And you have tens of thousands of calls. And the tool is actually very lightweight, so you can put this tool onto a production run, because all you're finding here are when is a function called, when is the method returned from, and were there any objects, when is an object allocated? You're not looking at any kind of stores or reads out of the heap. It's just calls and allocations, so it's very lightweight. But how are you going to look here and find temporaries? The answer is you're not. Okay. Here's another way of looking at that same data. This is actually a tree. At the top is the main program. This is dead, so I'm sorry. At the top is the main program, and there's this tree structure of A equals B equals C equals D. And so maybe if you put structure in it, you look at that data in a different way, it'd be easier. But actually, it's not. Okay? We have to offer people something better to use. So this is really the motivation for the work behind here. Now, this is some of our results. I'm not going to explain them in detail here, but on the vertical axis, it's a log scale. Okay? And the blue line basically gives, for each of these four benchmarks, which we'll talk about, the blue line gives you how many calling contexts, how many different stacks, unique stacks, you'd have to look at if you were a programmer and you were using that tool I just showed you. Okay? Notice it's tens of thousands, all right? Not viable. You're not going to look through those and find object turn. By applying a static analysis, we can get down to the pink line. Okay, we can actually figure out which of those blue contexts have temporaries. That's the way to think of it. Which of them actually have temporaries? So looking at the entire trace is blue. Looking at an analysis filtered trace is purple or pink. And down here in the yellow is the final results of the analysis I'm going to talk to you about. We've gone down two orders of magnitude in terms of the number of contexts you have to look at, and a programmer can look at 70 places. It sounds like a lot, but compared to 8,000, it's not a lot, and you can get experienced at this. So we want to use analysis to be able to take that tracing tool down to a viable level for an experienced developer in this domain to look at things. So that's the goal. I mean, we actually achieved this, but this really shows you in a very dramatic way how analysis can help, okay, what the promise of this research is. Two orders of magnitude less things for a person to look at. So now let me show you an overview of what we're actually doing. Okay. This is a graphical representation of the innards of a method in Java, okay? The nodes are an instruction. Just think of a statement, okay? Each node is a statement. The boxes here that look like diamonds are decision points, conditional flow, if statements, while statements, so the flow can go out of them in one of two ways. And this is a little fake method. You have an entry, you have an exit. I'm assuming a unique entry and exit. And each of these boxes has a Java statement, like a function call here, which is returning a reference to some object, which is now getting stored into a reference variable. Or it could be an object creation statement, like this one up here. Is everybody okay with this as a model of a method, a graphical model? This is the kind of thing, if you've taken compilers, you would have seen before. Okay, this is one method. Now, how do I build a program representation that's graphical if I have calls to other methods? Well, you can think here of connecting this node out to the entry of the called of the target method. And it has its own graph. And then at the exit of that target method, you would connect back the return to this place. And then you have a graphical representation of the calling structure of the program, and each method in that calling structure is a node that basically has a whole graph associated with it like this. So is everybody okay with that? That's the program model. Now, in compile time analysis, let me talk about the two worlds. You have the execution world, where you actually have a trace and you have calls, you can instrument, you can measure, you have object instances being created, you have real dynamic instances of objects happening, and then over here, we have the static analysis world. The static analysis world is trying to understand what can happen at execution time. So I need two things. I need a program representation, like this is what I take as my method, some graphical representation with the calls too. I need a representation of the calling structure. And then I need some way to talk about the property that I'm interested in finding out about the program. So I need some way to represent where are the temporaries used and where are the methods that when I call them end up in a piece of the call tree that uses a lot of temporaries. So is everybody okay with those two pieces? I have to, in my modeling static world, talk about objects. Now, clearly, I don't know all the instances over here. I can't, at compile time, know all the objects that are going to be created. So over here, I represent instances that are going to be created by the place of creation, by the creation site, the new site up here. So all the objects that at runtime will be created here are going to correspond to a particular abstract object in my static analysis. So I'm going to be talking about objects that the analysis finds and instances that correspond to them because they were created at runtime. Everybody still with me? Because we have to go between these two worlds because we're going to be analyzing one and measuring the other. Okay. Now, sorry about this. That you weren't supposed to see. That's what happens when you copy a slide that has buried animation. You don't realize it. Okay, so I have my program representation. Here's what static analysis does. Standard compile-time static analysis, it takes the representation I had there, and it makes some assumptions, and then it analyzes that graphical representation to figure out where the temporaries are found. Okay, at a very high level, that's what it does. What our new analysis is going to do is the following. We take the Java. We're going to profile Java. We're going to figure out which method calls what on a particular execution. We're going to watch which object instances are created. So we're going to keep track of object instances and calls. That's all we're going to do, very lightweight profiling. Then I'm going to build a calling structure. Method 1 calls method 2 calls method 3. And I'm going to actually make it a graph, although we have in the analysis there are many ways, many different structures you could build. Mine's going to be a call graph, and that means the methods are the nodes and the calls are the edges between them. Is that clear? I mean, if you have a trace that's a tree of all the calls, you can build a graph from it. Okay, you collapse all the calls of to one method and into one node. Okay? And then I'm going to take those models of the methods I showed you and the calling structure that I've measured now, not that I've approximated, which is what static analysis would do with dynamic dispatch, but that I've measured, and together I'm going to do a static analysis of those methods in that calling structure. So it's a blend, partly static, partly dynamic, and the dynamic part is because I'm actually seeing the calls on one particular execution. Which one? The one that has the performance problem. Okay, if it demonstrates the performance problem, that's the one I want to know more about. So the idea here is that the actual calling structure that we care about has demonstrated a problem that we put here, but we want to go in deeper than we're allowed to just instrument because we can't really perturb the execution of the program. So we're just picking out the calls and the object instantiations. And so we're using static analysis methods to look at the methods in this calling structure as though it was a plain static analysis. But it actually is a static analysis restricted to this one calling structure, whereas usually in compile time analysis, you're looking at overall executions. You're building a model of all executions. So that's the sense in which it's not standard. So there's two ways it's not standard. One is we're using this dynamic calling structure. And then a second way is that we're not limited by some of the limitations of static analysis. So when you do a static analysis in Java or C Sharp or any language that has dynamic class loading, there's a problem. Because in static analysis, you need the whole program. You know, you need to look at the code for the whole program to be a safe static analysis. Well, here, the profiler can watch the classes that are loaded and add those in. So now the static analysis knows about those classes too. Okay? And similarly, reflection is a problem to static analysis because when you see a call through the reflection library, you don't know the target of the call at compile time. You can do some analysis and try to estimate it, but we can get it exactly because we have the method that was called. We have a profile. We have a trace. So those are two sources of approximation and imprecision in normal compile-time static analysis that we can avoid with this blended analysis. And so that's very appealing. Okay. Another thing we figured out is that we can use some of the observations of the profiler to help prune these representations of the methods to something more exact. For example, if we know that in this execution we're watching, only B objects were instantiated, not A objects, then we know this new statement for an A was never executed on this run. So we can get rid of it. Similarly, if we know that whatever method this is only called D's M and never called C's M, which is underneath here, we can get rid of unexecuted calls. And then we can do a reachability analysis on this graph and get rid of more stuff. So this is called pruning. So we're pruning the method representations so as to try to introduce more precision of what might have happened on this run. Again, it's for this run. Okay? No one looks happy. I have to tell you, you don't look happy. And ask me a question if I'm losing you. I really don't want to. I'd rather say less and have you understand. Everybody okay so far? Okay. Even unhappy nods would be okay. But nods are very reassuring when you're up here. Okay. So now, this is actually what we do. This is the whole thing. And over here, we have these pruned models of the methods, these reduced models, using some of our dynamic information. Okay, so that's the whole deal. That's what we're doing. Okay, so now let me explain to you escape analysis. So you're going to be able to impress your friends and tell them that you know something about static analysis. So escape analysis is a standard compiler analysis that's used in programs with dynamically created data. Okay, what you want to know is, does a dynamically created object instance, can it be accessed beyond when control returns from the method that created it? Right? Some method creates an object, puts it in a heap. Some other objects get called. Eventually, you return from the creator. can I get to that object? Is there a reference in some field of some other object or some global variable or whatever? Is there a way to get to that object? Or has it become garbage, right? That's what garbage collection is about in object-oriented languages. All right? So does the object escape from its creating method? That's what escape analysis is about. This was important because it was used for storage optimizations. If you knew the object didn't escape from its creating method, you didn't have to put it in the general heap where it would be garbage collected, to put it on the stack in a place that is local storage for its creating method. So that's neither here nor there. So that's escape analysis. It's a standard analysis that's been done. And objects, that is, I'm over here in the analysis world, right? I have a model of the program. I have a model of the objects that are going to be instantiated. So an object, a representation of something that happens at execution time, gets one of these three characterizations. Either it's captured, meaning it's a temporary, okay? It was created, it was used, and then it no longer can be seen. So depending on how long that time period, lifetime was, how many call hops it was, we might consider it a temporary. Or it's arg escaping, meaning at some point in time it's created and then it's passed back to the caller through an argument. And that can happen through several levels of call. Or it's globally escaping. So imagine that you have a static field in the class and you store a reference to this object in that static field. Well, that's it. I mean, that stays around for the whole execution, right? It's a global variable. And so then the object could be globally escaping because it's globally accessible. You have that reference to it in that static field. That's standard escape analysis. It marks every one of the objects in the analysis as one of these three things. And it builds a graphical representation of the objects that point to one another through fields, of the reference variables that point to objects. So you get a picture. You get an approximation of what the heap really looks like. Okay? Now, it's in the analysis world, so these aren't individual instances of objects. These are representations of those objects in their fields. But you do get a picture of, you know, which can A objects created here point to B objects created there, things of that sort. So you know something about the data structures. So this is what people had before. You see, I've referenced the analysis we had. And the one thing I glossed over about our approach is that in that picture where I showed you what the blended analysis paradigm was, there was this node that said static analysis. And the nice thing, the reason I call this a paradigm, that is a family of algorithms, is that you could put any standard static analysis there. Okay? And so we can take this escape analysis and put it there. Now, it turned out that for these programs, we had to change the analysis a little. We had to enrich this escape analysis. But think of it as an enhancement. I mean, the real heavy-duty work of figuring out how to do escape analysis was done by previous people. We changed it a little to use it in this object churn manner. And so now I'm going to teach by example, right? I'm going to teach you all about escape analysis through an example. So this is not a formal definition. This is an informal, to give you some kind of intuition about what we are doing. And I will show you similarly informal connection graphs. These are not as detailed as the information we gather, but it gives you the idea of what we gather. Okay, so I'm assuming everybody can read Java. So we have this little program, a little method that creates an A object, stores a B object into its field, and then you guys tell me, does that A object escape from bar? When I come back from the call to bar, can I get to the A object? No, because the reference variable is local, right? And when I get back, it goes away. All right, so here's what the analysis would do. We look at the code, we create a little box for A, that's the A object, we create a little box for the B object, and we color them, when we leave bar, we color them green. They are captured. That is a little temporary data structure. Something captured inside its creating method, all right? And this is a pretty trivial one because the creating method doesn't call any others. Okay, now we look at Boz. Boz causes, the code in Boz causes three objects to be created and causes these relationships. C actually points to E through its Y field, E through its Z field and D through its Y field. And then we see return of C. So since C is returned, That means it's a return parameter. That means C is escaping Boz. Sorry, not C. The little C object that was created there at the new site will escape because there'll be a pointer to it out in the calling context. All right? So we're going to color these blue because they're arg escaping. Those objects are arg escaping. They were created in a callee, and they can be accessed up in a caller. Okay? Now, next example. We need someone to call Bar and Boz, so we have here Foo, which calls Boz, and here the first thing that happens, now you see something else. The other two, these were simpler methods because they didn't have any arguments. Now we have to, in our connection graph, be able to represent an object in the calling environment, which we only see through the formal parameter in the called environment. That's what this F is, and that's why it has the dotted line. Because it's not really an F, well, it is an F object, but we don't know which one. We don't know which allocation site it corresponds to down inside of Foo. Okay? And we can see that the call of Boz here returns a little data structure which looks just like the one that escaped from Boz, which is what we expect. And then we make the W field of the F object point to what the Z field of the C object points to. That puts that little edge in there, and then colors change. So why did these colors change? On exit of Foo, the only thing we can see up in the caller of Foo is the argument F, whatever the F object was, and this object E that F points to. We color those things blue because they're arg escaping. The two green ones, the green objects, now are lost. There's no way to get to them when we return to the caller. And so they are captured. And again, depending on the number of calls, we might consider these temporaries or not. Okay, is everybody still with me? Then at the top, we call Foo, and you can see what's going to happen. We create one of these F objects, we call Foo, so that F object is made to point to an E because of the call. And then, as the last statement here, we put a pointer to that F object in a global field, a static field of the G class, and that's going to turn them all to red. So those objects now are globally escaping. Okay, makes sense what these different words mean at different points of execution, at different places in our model. This is representing an execution, an analysis. At different places, we can tell the characteristic of particular objects. So presumably, if we find a lot of green ones down underneath some method, that means whatever these calls are doing underneath that method, during that time of execution, we're using temporaries, temporary data structures. I'm saying data structure for this kind of thing, objects created, you know, connected to one another. Okay. Now, disposition is a word that we use to represent the final escape state of an object. So what this picture shows is that we can consider objects to have different escape states depending on where in the calling structure they are. In the original analysis, there was one global state. So if you ever escaped, you were considered escaping. But here, the E up here in Foo is considered to be, well, that's not a good one. The C here is considered to be arg escaping in Boz, but once you get up to Foo, that's where it stops. Okay, so it can have two different states and two different methods, and that's something a little different. And so what our disposition metric measures is the final state, you know, as you back up out of these calls, the final state of an object. So we end up with four of them being captured and three of them being globally escaping. And I'm going to show you measurements of our analysis on real code of disposition. Okay, so that's escape analysis by example. Here's the kind of thing. This drawing is a drawing of data that we actually calculated with our blended analysis. So let me try to explain what this is. This is a piece of the execution tree, okay? The dashed edges are paths in the tree. So I'm not showing you every single call. I'm collapsing some calls. And the reason I'm doing that is that these nodes correspond to capturing calling context. So there's some temporaries there. there's some green object, you know, data structures there. And I don't care about contexts that don't capture anything, so I just got rid of them by putting paths here. When we look at this tree, this corresponds, and it says up there, to the particular method that this corresponds to in our financial transaction benchmark, which is called trade, which is a standard one. I'll show you more about that. The numbers in here are actually corresponding to the instances captured. So again, I'll go between my worlds. Over here in the analysis world, I mark each one of these nodes as, which is a method call, right? A method called in a certain context. I'm saying these things capture temporaries. But my representation of these temporaries are all the objects created at some place, okay? But over here in the dynamic world of the execution, I have a way in my analysis of saying which objects I watched being created got created basically in that method of that kind. And therefore, I can map how many actual instances I saw to these representations of objects in the analysis. Everybody still okay with that? So that's how I can show the user a picture of paths in the execution tree with captured or temporary objects, captured objects and data structures, and the numbers of actual instances that were captured. Okay, so I'm combining the two worlds, the trace and the analysis world. This particular subtree, just to get a handle on what really happens, has 476 different call stacks. Remember, these dashed lines have nodes on them. These are pans. Okay, so I've condensed things. 476 contexts, 223 distinct methods on these paths. And the call stack max depth, that is the number of calls, methods that have been entered and not returned from, is 20. Imagine a person trying to do this without some kind of tool help. I would contend if you have 20 deep, you're going to lose it. You're not going to be able to trace through code that you haven't written very easily. And so this is the kind of information we can give back to the user. Now, there were in this piece of the execution, there were 290 instances, 290 objects created, okay, in all these nodes in here, and even the ones deleted on the paths. Of those, 262 were temporaries, okay? So when you see a lot of captured things out of all the things created in a region, you got a pretty good feel that maybe you should look deeper into that region. There may be object churn going on. And the information that the user would have just from the dynamic information would be the 290 instances. But they'd have no information whatsoever without the analysis about whether they were captured or escaping or, you know, how were the instances used. So that's the value added that the program analysis is given the developer. Okay, so now we went down a little deeper. We looked at the tree. You said, wow, there's 108 instances here. What's going on there? And this is the graph of the object connections for that method. And when you look at this, it's not a coincidence that all these numbers are divisible by 9. This graph happens to lie totally inside Java, the Java libraries, rather than between two libraries. But this call structure is basically representing execution all within one Java library. Evidently, to do date conversions, they use Gregorian calendars, okay? And they create a new one, and then they come down here and use some kind of arrays inside of the calendar class, and more arrays, and then finally something goes back to do a date conversion from one date to another, okay? From one format to another. Now, Gregorian calendar has very complex initialization. And so you might want to cache. You know, the first time you do it, you go into Gregorian calendar and a computation might want to create the temporary data structure, initialize all the constant fields, and then maybe leave out the fields that have to be input by the conversion routine, and then remember that you have that. And then you can avoid the initialization, you can avoid the creation of the Gregorian calendar, and the next time you come in with a date convert as part of this execution, you don't have to do that. I know this sounds like just a little thing, but these programs use these kinds of repeated operations over and over and over again. And in this case, we could suggest something within one library. More usually, it's interactions between more than one library that we end up finding. But this is the kind of thing that you could go back now to the library writer and say, hey, is there some, or to the compiler person with the library writer and say, is there some way we should specialize execution so that when you do this repeated number of times, you don't keep allocating objects? Now, these are an actual visualization. Given the data structure that we create, the solution that we create, those connection graphs, we run it through the DOT program from Bell Labs, and this is what you actually see. So it's the same picture as I had before, but it's taken straight from the data. It shows you the arg escaping things, which are strings, which makes sense because you're converting one date to another format. So what should escape is the other format, which is expressed as a string. Okay. So, let me talk now about real experiments, you know, with real with real codes, and try to show you some data that's aggregated over a certain kind of application. So there is a benchmark. A lot of this stuff says IBM. WebSphere is a set of IBM libraries that support web applications. Trade is all these things are open. You can get these as an academic, these versions of them as an academic to do research. Trade is as I said, a financial holdings kind of an application. You get in there and you say, you know, what stocks do I have? What bonds do I have? Whatever. You say, sell these, buy those, that kind of thing. So there's a lot of transaction database access-based kinds of operations. Now down here in the maroon, you can actually set up this application with four different configurations underneath it. Remember, it's being supported by all these libraries. And there's two things you get to do. How do you access the database? Do you use a direct access library like JDBC, or do you use Java Beans, Enterprise Java Beans? And depending on that choice, you get two different looking underneath parts of the iceberg. And so we can do the analysis and pretend it's like two different benchmarks because they really have very different characteristics. Similarly, how do you access the network? Do you use web services? Do you use some standard library? And again, you get different underpinnings and very different looking benchmarks. So other people have used this application on various other kinds of research projects, and all four combinations, with taking one choice from each one of those, is used as a different benchmark. We also took a piece of the Eclipse compiler and used that as a benchmark as well, okay, on a standard kind of on your desktop machine. Okay, so let me just give you an idea of how complicated and large these things are. In the yellow, those are all the trade benchmarks in the different configurations. So if it used the direct standard combination of the two libraries, it's in the top row. Direct web services is the next row, and so forth. And in this last row is the JDT compiler. And the columns are, these are all dynamic data. How many types were actually allocated? How many instances of objects were actually allocated? How many methods were there in the calling structure? How many calls were there in the calling structure? And finally, what was the maximum stack of this call stack? So I show you this to try to show you that, and this is all mapping one transaction that domain experts said, you know, this is the piece of the program that's not behaving well, we need to go look at this. These are just things derived from our dynamic analysis. Now the thing you can observe here is that when you add web services as the way you access the network, it makes things more complicated. It increases the number of types of data, types of objects created, it certainly increases the number of calls, okay? So if you look at direct plus web versus direct.standard, and you look at these two rows, you can see that things get much more complicated. Also, whenever you add the EJBs as the way of accessing the database, going through the beans, rather than using a direct library to go through the beans, similarly, you get more complicated, a more complicated program with many, many more calls, with many, many more allocated instances. Luckily, the two things don't multiply. That is, if you use beans and web services, you don't get the worst of the two of them. Okay, so even though this bottom one is the most complicated combination, you don't get the worst thing. So I'm showing you this because I'm going to show you data about use of temporaries based on these five benchmarks, okay? So I want you to see what kind of programs they are. These are not things you'd open your debugger and try to run. That's the point that you have to believe. Okay, so the first thing we tried to measure was how much did we gain from that optimization that let us cut some of the nodes out of the method representation, okay? And we also wanted to see, did cutting those extra nodes out or refining those graphs for the methods, did that make the analysis more precise? And I'm giving you here the punchline. The precision didn't improve. So we have data, but it's not conclusive that the precision actually improved. But if we look at this chart, you can see that it made a substantive, the pruning made a substantive difference in the size of the graphs. If you look down here, these are all the benchmarks, and these are the, this is the percentage diminishment in the size of the graphs. You know, how much smaller the pruned ones were than the original ones. So you get more than 35% less nodes on average in the method graphs. And in these kinds of analyses, storage is everything. So the running time of the algorithm is very related to the amount of storage that you that it takes, because you have to build the program representation, you have to build a representation of your solution, that is these object graphs that we're creating, these connection graphs, and you got to push these connection graphs around that graph, around the program, the model of the program. And so if you need less storage, you can do more complicated programs, either with more complicated solutions or with more methods. Okay, so that's a cost issue. This is definitely related directly to cost. Here, the NAs mean that we couldn't even, in the time we were willing to let the thing run, finish the analysis unless we pruned. Okay? Truth in advertising. We let it go a day. It finished or it didn't finish? Didn't finish in a day? No, we need the pruning. Now, this is 18 hours, and I know for an academic audience, I'm really surprised there isn't like a swift intake of breath. What? What? And I was up at Accenture last week in Chicago, and people said, you mean if we ran it for a day, we'd have this quality of information? That's wonderful. So it's all relative, guys, you know. People are out there in the real world dealing with things like the screenshot I showed you in the beginning. So no, we're not happy with 18, you know, but I'm not going to make my students stay in graduate school until he gets that down to 2 hours. We know that that's a to-do, all right? We know that's a to-do. But we did finish. And notice that that was for the hardest one, the beans plus the web services, the biggest, most complicated version of the program, okay? And so we get a speed up because of the smaller size of about 1.5, which is good. It means we can do bigger, more complicated programs, more edges in the graph, more nodes in the graph. But as I said, we didn't see the precision improvement. We still don't understand why. Now we want to try to look at the usage of the temporary. So I'll show you two of these. Disposition I showed you already in the example. We want to know eventually, do all the objects, again, I'm in my analysis world here, how many of the objects escape eventually? You know, they go back through callers and then escape. How many are captured eventually, so there are possibilities for temporaries? And how many go up one way and escape and go up another way, you know, on another path and might be captured? So that's what disposition tells us. So this is the disposition of the instances. Remember, I'm able to look at the objects in the static world and map them to the instances I observed in the profile. Okay, so this is instances. So on the right, we say this is a percentage of the instances, the actual objects created in each escape state. And this is across all the benchmarks. And the escape states are, the dark color is captured. So there's about 50% of them captured. Now, they might not all be temporaries. I mean, it depends on the extent of the program they're captured in. But that's how this is certainly makes it feasible that maybe this analysis is needed, that this really is a problem, like people told us in the domain. They said this is really a problem in these programs. Well, this kind of supports that. It's interesting, the blue part, a light blue, is saying these escaped. Now, they could have really been escaping, or it could be our analysis isn't precise enough, because when the analysis approximates, when it says something's captured, it's always captured. When it says something escapes, maybe it's captured, we just can't figure it out, or maybe it escapes. So it's safe to say something escapes, so we approximate by saying it escapes. okay? The yellow part are things that have these two paths that, you know, they might escape on one and not escape on the other. So the interesting thing here is most objects get one color or the other. I'm sorry, I misspoke. Most instances get one color or the other. Okay, this is probably the hardest graph. All right, so take all the capturing methods, method contests, sorry, all the capturing calling contexts. So we have a method executed with some stack next to it, so there's some context it's being executed in, and rank them from top to bottom, the capturing ones as captured the most, captured the second most, captured the third most, and so forth, okay? If I look at the top 5% of the capturing calling contexts, that's what's in the dark color here. The top 5% capture this many of the instances. Everybody okay with that? So the top 5% capturing method contexts, how many of these instances are they actually getting? They're getting about 18% of the captured instances. And if I go up and include the top 10%, I can get about 30% of the captured instances. Why is this interesting? That's what you should be saying. Yeah. It could correspond to how often the method is called if it uses temporaries. The other reason it's interesting from a compiler writer's point of view is that if only a few methods are responsible for most of these temporary data structures being created and thrown away, then there's hope. We can go into either one library or a combination of libraries that's used often and go in and try to optimize. If the temporaries are strewn all over the program, it's much harder for a compiler writer to try to find ways to optimize. Okay, so you want the red bar to be as high as you can. Now, here, it's very high, and actually that's not a surprise, because this is a compiler, and compilers, you know, they create something and then they throw it away because in the next pass they don't need it. You know, they create the AST, and then they go from the AST to the intermediate representation. They don't need maybe the AST anyway, so there's probably, that may just be an artifact of the kind of data that, of the application being very different. We did it because it was using a lot of libraries in the Eclipse system, so it fits our paradigm. But one last metric. There's more, but I don't want to. I want to have time for questions. So another thing that people don't know about in this domain is they really don't know what these temporary data structures look like. Okay, because these are interactions between more than one library and framework. People haven't been able to dynamically look at them, you know, to try to record them. And so one thing we can do is try to help people figure out what do these temporaries look like. Well, not surprisingly, many, many, many of them have only one data type. Many, many, many are just, you know, some primitive thing, primitive field. Two is probably a string, because a string would have array of char, and we would count that as two data types, because it's an array of chars. But look, there's quite a few of them out here that have 5 to 11 data types, or 3 or 4 data types. And for some of these, I mean, we've even seen 12 data types in some kinds of structures. And if we're out in this end, I mean, that means these temporary data structures probably would be hard to find just by looking at the code. Because there's lots of types of things that are each being created on different calls to different methods, and it might be quite difficult to find these things unless you had some sort of tool support like this. By the way, when we look at these things, we can tell people, they can point, you know, we know what the data structure looks like, right? We have that connection graph. We can point to this and say, where was it created? And where was it last used? And things like that. So we have additional information. Okay, I want to wrap up. So I put these on the slides because I knew I couldn't talk about it, but I think you really have to always have related work. Nobody does research, you know, like out of the blue. There has been other work done trying to understand what these programs look like, what the data structures in these programs look like, and many of the work listed here is that kind of characterization. Not enough of it has been done because these programs usually choke research prototypes. Okay, when you saw how many calls there were, and I have to represent all those calls in some kind of program model, you can imagine how big the model gets, and I still don't have any storage left over for the information I want to propagate around the model. So this is a new area for researchers. There have been other people that have tried ideas of combining, you know, the static kind of compile time analysis with profiling and dynamic analysis. Most of them have been in a particular problem domain, and I've told you some of the things I think are unique about what we're doing, in that you can take lots of different static analyses and plunk them into that static analysis node on the graph. Okay, so I am going to finish. What I've tried to show you, I hope I've succeeded, is to give you some intuition. That was all I wanted to do. What's the kind of work that I do? What's the kind of work Mark's doing with me? What's the kind of work I'll do here and I've done in the past? You see a problem, you devise a program analysis to help build tools to either help the user solve the problem or to solve it automatically. You prototype the tools, you do experimentation with a lot of validation, with a lot of characterization of the solutions you get. And so you have sort of algorithm papers and you have experiential papers. And so we've been looking at this blended analysis paradigm on one problem so far. And that's my student's thesis. What we want to do beyond this is we want to build some kind of tool so you can look at these object graphs, these connection graphs in Eclipse. We want to experiment with different kinds of calling structures and see what the effect is on the solution. We still think we can get more precise solutions. We want to look at bigger benchmarks. So Bruno is now looking at a customer trace from IBM. It's been anonymized, of course, and they'll shoot us if we say whose it is, so we're not allowed to know whose it is. But a real live customer's trace. So it's very exciting to be able to take a research prototype and have it gobble up something that was a problem for a real customer in the financial world, probably. We also have another application on top of a collaborative work framework at IBM. And the second thing that we're doing is we're trying to look at other kinds of analyses, other problems that could benefit from having this combined static and dynamic analysis applied. Some of these are security analyses, and the idea there is that when people do a dynamic analysis, they just find security violations. Okay? They do a runtime check, and oh, doesn't have enough permissions, okay, violation, and you redo things. If they do a static analysis, they get a big overestimate as to what permissions each part of the system should have. And so our approach is somewhere in the middle there, and if we find a set of permissions that also is found by the static analysis, then maybe the static analysis people would have more comfort, more confidence that those permissions are real. They're really needed, because even this partly dynamic analysis found them. We don't know. Okay. I left a minute. I wanted to leave more. I would be more than glad to take questions, or a question, or questions after. Yes, Eli. Yes and no. So, yeah, I mean, the first analysis algorithms were for compiler optimization. So the whole thing about optimizing compilers is that it's not supposed to change your program behavior, right? Not supposed to change your program meaning. So to do that, you have to look at the code and be able to figure out what the meaning is so that you don't invalidate that meaning. And in the early and mid-70s, people like Fran Allen and Gary Kildall were doing these kinds of analyses in compilers. And then C came, and C had these great pointers that the OS guys love and that analysis people learn to hate, because you can do arithmetic on values, and analysis people are supposed to figure out what you're pointing to, and this kind of stuff happens. So there was a boom in my own work and other people's work on, well, what is this pointer pointing to in C? And of course, that just went over into C++ and Java and C#, because references are kind of like tamed pointers, if you want to think of it that way. They can be null, but they can't be pointing into the middle of a word, you know? I mean, they're kind of semi-tamed pointers. The compiler community is concentrating now on analysis for parallel. And there are static analysis people who are trying to find atomic portions of programs, or validating being able to get rid of synchronizations that are unnecessary because they can prove that this piece of code is always local in the thread, is never going to have two threads trying to access it, those kinds of things. So they're still doing analysis. It's just the new work has drifted more into that domain. There's also still people doing very, very complex static and heavy cost static analyses on shapes. You know, they want to look in the heap in a Java program or a C++ program and say, what does that data structure look like? What's inside that hash map? You know, where were those objects created that are in that hash map kind of things? But it's true that the analysis community sort of has migrated in some sense over to software engineering to building tools. And in my own case, I am very biased. This is a totally subjective opinion. I like research that has some practical import. So in my, you know, advanced work or what we're going to do future work slides, I mean, yeah, as an analysis person, if it's a cool analysis problem, I want to look at it. But it's much more interesting if there's some practical application. And so the analysis people in software engineering tend to at least have a practical application in mind, even if their prototypes won't quite get them there, you know, like the 18 hours. I'm not going to sell this thing, right? But I mean, the idea gives an idea to someone who could take it and then, you know, maybe go somewhere with it. So it has been kind of that kind of circuitous way. And there's also been a lot of work lately on a resurgence of work on verification. And so in the software engineering community, there's always verification and testing, right? They're like two sides of the same thing. You want to build confidence in software. Testing builds confidence by being able to know, you know, tests can't demonstrate an error, and if you do enough testing and find enough errors, you begin to get confidence. But you don't prove anything's correct. You just kind of exhaustively get tired of checking. That's basically the way to think about it. Verification are formal techniques, like model checking, like type state analysis, much more advanced than just plain weakest precondition, although obviously that was the groundwork. Formal techniques to try to show validity of programs. And the interesting thing is that these two seemingly opposite approaches have now come together. So people do what they call bounded model checking, which means they prove something correct out to this many steps, or they prove data structures of that kind correct out to that depth. And so there's lots of crossover now in the analysis community between different approaches in software engineering and different approaches in compiling. You should not press the analysis button. I really like what I do. Thank you very much. Thanks for your attention.